Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to the award-winning podcast where we investigate cutting-edge research with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host Jen.
Hey there, listeners. Today, we're diving into a fascinating paper that takes a close look at energy and carbon trends in North Africa. The title of the paper is Trend in Energy Intensity and Carbon Performance in North Africa, and it was authored by Grakale Gurin, Samia Mansour Hamuda, and Zuzana Brikshiva Swidrowski from the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa.
This is a really important topic, Jen. North Africa is a region that has struggled to decouple economic growth from environmental degradation and carbon emissions. Even as the countries in this region have seen their GDP per capita rise, their carbon emissions have continued to grow at an alarming rate.
That's right, Tom. The researchers set out to examine the recent trends in emissions and the key drivers behind changes in carbon intensity, energy intensity, and per capita emissions across North Africa. They also analyzed the impact of policies like energy taxes and efficiency standards on the energy performance of small and medium-sized enterprises in the region.
Fascinating. Let's start by looking at the big picture trends in carbon emissions across North Africa. What did the researchers find?
The data paints a concerning picture. Over the period from 1990 to 2020, the region as a whole experienced a staggering 130% growth in carbon emissions from fossil fuels. That's more than double the global average increase of around 50% over the same time frame.
Wow, that's a huge jump. And were there differences between the individual countries in North Africa?
Definitely. The researchers broke down the trends on a country-by-country basis, and the results were quite varied. Mauritania and Sudan saw the highest growth rates, with emissions increasing by nearly 300% in both countries. Libya, on the other hand, actually experienced a decline in emissions due to the negative impact of political instability on economic activity.
That's an interesting contrast. What about the other countries in the region? Algeria, Egypt, Morocco, and Tunisia. How did their emissions trajectories compare?
Those countries showed a more mixed picture. Egypt and Morocco saw emissions grow by around 180 to 190% over the three decades. Algeria and Tunisia fared a bit better, with emissions increases in the 100 to 115% range. But the key point is that none of these countries were able to achieve any real decoupling of economic growth and carbon output.
Right, that's the crucial issue here. Even the relatively better performing countries in North Africa are still struggling to break the tight link between development and environmental degradation. So what were the driving factors behind these emission trends?
The researchers used a really fascinating analytical approach to decompose the changes in carbon emissions into three key components: population growth, economic activity, and carbon intensity. Let's start with the region as a whole.
Okay, walk us through the regional level findings.
From 1990 to 2000, the 45% increase in emissions was driven almost equally by population growth and economic expansion. Then in the 2000s, the further 50% rise was mainly due to economic activity, with a slight 4.4% improvement in carbon intensity providing a bit of a counterweight. But the 2010s told a different story. Carbon emissions actually declined compared to the previous decade, which the researchers attribute to a decrease in economic activity as well as some gains in carbon intensity through renewable energy investments.
That's really interesting. So, population growth was a major factor driving emissions higher in the earlier periods, but more recently, changes in the carbon intensity of economic activity have become more influential. Can you dig into that country-by-country analysis you mentioned earlier?
Absolutely. The trends varied quite a bit across North African nations. In Algeria and Mauritania during the 1990s, emissions were overwhelmingly driven by population growth, with economic activity actually declining. Meanwhile, in Egypt and Morocco, both population and economic growth were pushing emissions higher, combined with worsening carbon intensity.
And how about the more recent periods? Were any of the countries able to achieve some degree of decoupling?
A few countries started to show some progress. Tunisia was able to achieve relative decoupling, with emissions growing at a slower pace than GDP over the 2000 to 2010 period. Egypt also managed to mitigate the effects of population and economic growth by reducing its carbon intensity in the 2010s, demonstrating a relative decoupling as well. Algeria, along with Egypt and Tunisia, emerged as the best performers in the region in terms of carbon intensity reduction over the full 1990 to 2020 timeframe. But Morocco, Sudan, Mauritania, and Libya still have a long way to go, with their carbon intensities either stagnating or even increasing. It's clear that North Africa as a whole has struggled to break the link between development and environmental damage. But the country-level differences suggest there may be important policy lessons to be learned. What did the researchers find when they looked at the impacts of specific policies?
That's a really crucial part of the analysis. The researchers wanted to understand how things like energy taxes and efficiency standards might be influencing the energy performance of small and medium-sized enterprises, or SMEs, in North Africa.
Right. SMEs are such an important part of the economy in this region, so their energy use and sustainability practices can have a big impact. The researchers used econometric modeling to examine the effects of these policy tools in Morocco, Egypt, and Tunisia.
And what did they find? Were the energy tax and standards policies effective in driving improvements in energy efficiency among SMEs?
The results were quite interesting. The researchers found that when SMEs were subject to energy tax policies or energy efficiency standards, they were significantly more likely to implement energy management practices, conduct energy monitoring, and adopt energy-efficient technologies. So the policy levers do seem to be moving the needle, at least when it comes to SME behavior. This suggests that ramping up those kinds of targeted interventions could be an important part of the solution for improving energy intensity and carbon performance across North Africa.
Absolutely. And I imagine coupling those kinds of regulatory approaches with other initiatives, like investment in renewable energy infrastructure and support for sustainable business practices, could create a really powerful package of solutions.
Definitely. The researchers conclude that North Africa has a lot of work to do to truly decouple its economic progress from environmental degradation. But the findings offer some promising pathways forward, from harnessing policy tools to drive efficiency gains, to capitalizing on the region's immense renewable energy potential.
This is such a critical issue, not just for North Africa, but for the entire global community. I'm really glad we could dive into this research and unpack both the challenges and the opportunities. It's a complex problem, but studies like this are helping to light the way.
Absolutely. This was a fascinating look under the hood of energy and carbon trends in North Africa. I think listeners will come away with a much richer understanding of the dynamics at play and the policy levers that could make a real difference. Thanks for joining us today, Tom. This was a great discussion.
My pleasure, Jen. And thank you all for tuning in. We'll catch you next time on the podcast, where we'll explore more groundbreaking research that's shaping our world. Until then, stay curious. Jingle plays. Are you tired of your business's high energy costs and carbon footprint dragging you down?
Introducing GreenWatt, the one-stop shop for all your energy efficiency and sustainability needs.
GreenWatt was founded by a team of researchers who literally wrote the book on decoupling economic growth from environmental destruction.
That's right. We took the findings from the trend in energy intensity and carbon performance in North Africa study and turned it into the ultimate business transformation package.
From smart energy audits to renewable energy installations to employee eco-training, GreenWatt has everything you need to green up your operations and save big on those utility bills.
Don't be like those inefficient North African enterprises. Call GreenWatt today and let us work our sustainable magic. Operators are standing by to take your call. In a whisper if they ever show up to work on time.
GreenWatt. Powering your business into a greener future. One solar panel at a time. Jingle plays. Here is a detailed podcast episode about the research paper Working from Home Increases Work-Home Distances. Intro music. Welcome to our award-winning podcast, where we dive deep into cutting-edge research to uncover the stories behind the science. I'm Tom, here with my co-host Jen.
Hi everyone. Today we're excited to discuss a fascinating new paper that investigates how the shift towards working from home during the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted the relationship between where people live and where they work. The paper is titled Working from Home Increases Work-Home Distances, and it's authored by a team of researchers from Germany, Sina Koskin, Wolfgang Dorf, Hermann Gartner, Michael Stops, and Enzo Weber.
This is a really interesting study that gets to the heart of how the sudden shift to remote work has reshaped labor markets and commuting patterns. The researchers found that as working from home became more widespread, the distance between people's homes and their workplaces actually increased, especially for jobs that had a high potential for remote work.
That's right, Tom. The key idea here is that when people no longer need to physically commute to an office every day, it opens up new possibilities in terms of where they can live. Rather than having to live close to their workplace, people with remote-friendly jobs can now live further away and still be able to do their work effectively.
Exactly. And the researchers used an innovative new measure they call the Home Office Potential or HOP indicator to capture how suitable different occupations are for remote work. They combined this HOP data with massive administrative records on employment and commuting in Germany to really dig into the effects.
So let's dive into the details. What did the researchers find?
Well, the main finding is that the link between a job's remote work potential and the distance between the employee's home and workplace strengthened significantly after the onset of the pandemic in 2020.
Interesting. Can you walk us through that a bit more? How did they establish that link?
Sure. Let me explain. The researchers used a difference in differences approach to compare changes in commuting distances over time for workers in occupations with high remote work potential versus those in occupations less suitable for remote work.
Okay, so they were basically looking at how the relationship between a job's remote work potential and the employee's commute changed before versus after the pandemic hit.
Exactly. And what they found is that prior to 2020, there was a stable positive correlation. Workers in occupations with higher HOP scores tended to have longer commutes on average. But then in 2021, after the big shift to remote work, that correlation strengthened substantially.
So the effect really kicked in a year after the pandemic started. Why the delay?
Well, the researchers think it's because the initial pandemic shock in 2020 was so abrupt and unexpected that people didn't immediately have the chance to re-optimize their living and working arrangements. But over the course of 2021, as remote work became more entrenched, workers in high HOP jobs were able to take advantage of the new flexibility and move further away from their workplace.
That makes sense. And the effect was even stronger for new jobs, right? Tell us more about that.
Yes, that's a really interesting finding. For new jobs started after the pandemic, the impact of remote work potential on commute distance was much larger than for existing jobs. This suggests that people were actively matching to jobs with high remote work potential that were located further away from where they lived.
Wow. So it seems like the pandemic has really reshaped how people are navigating the trade-offs between housing costs, job opportunities, and commuting. Do the results offer any insights into that dynamic?
Definitely. The researchers found that the effect was especially pronounced for jobs located in big cities. Typically, people living and working in urban centers have shorter commutes, but that tendency weakened after 2021. It seems that with remote work, the relevant labor markets of big cities have expanded, allowing people to live further away while still accessing those job opportunities.
Interesting. That suggests remote work is allowing a bit more separation between where people live and where they work, even in high-cost urban areas. Any other notable findings?
Yes. One other key result is that the researchers didn't find significant evidence that commuting patterns changed more for women than for men, despite the common perception that remote work could help narrow the gender commuting gap. If anything, the difference in real estate prices between the workplace and home location increased more for men.
That's a bit surprising. I would have expected remote work to provide more flexibility that women in particular could take advantage of. But I guess the story is more nuanced.
Absolutely. This research really highlights the complexity of how the shift to remote work is reshaping labor markets and residential choices. There's a lot more going on than just people being able to live further from the office.
Definitely. This is such a thought-provoking study. The researchers did a great job leveraging detailed German employment data and their novel HOP indicator to unpack these dynamics. It'll be really interesting to see how these trends evolve going forward as remote work becomes more entrenched.
I agree. This is a great example of how rigorous, data-driven research can illuminate the profound societal changes underway. By focusing on the nuanced relationship between where people live and where they work, this study offers crucial insights into the future of work.
Absolutely. Well, there's certainly a lot to unpack here. Thanks for joining us today, listeners. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes where we explore more cutting-edge research. Until next time, this is Jen.
Dot and Tom, signing off. Outro music. Jingle plays. Are you tired of the same old commute? Sick of sitting in traffic for hours just to get to the office?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing Remote Living.
That's right. Remote Living is the revolutionary new service that helps you find your dream home, no matter how far it is from your workplace.
With Remote Living, you can finally ditch the dreaded daily commute and live anywhere your heart desires. Whether it's a cozy cabin in the mountains or a seaside villa on the coast, we'll help you find the perfect remote-friendly home.
No more being tied down to a desk in the city. With Remote Living, the whole world is your office.
Just log on, pick your dream location, and let our expert matchmakers handle the rest. We'll pair you with the ideal high-hop job to complement your new remote lifestyle.
So what are you waiting for? Experience the freedom of remote living today.
Visit remoteliving.com to get started. Remote living work from anywhere. Jingle plays.
Here is a detailed podcast episode transcript about the research paper, a note on Sen's representation of the Gini coefficient, revision and repercussions. Welcome to Inquiring Minds, the podcast that takes a deep dive into the latest groundbreaking research. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. In this episode, we'll be examining a fascinating paper that offers a new perspective on a classic measure of income inequality.
The paper is titled A Note on Sen's Representation of the Gini Coefficient, Revision and Repercussions, and was written by economist Oded Stark.
The Gini coefficient is a widely used statistic for quantifying the degree of inequality in the distribution of income or wealth within a population. It's named after the Italian statistician Corrado Gini, who first developed the measure in 1912.
What's interesting about this new paper is that it takes a critical look at how the Gini coefficient has been represented and interpreted, particularly drawing on the work of Nobel laureate Amartya Sen. The authors uncover an important limitation in Sen's formulation and propose a potential solution.
The key issue centers around the fact that when the income distribution is extremely unequal, with one person receiving all the income, Sen's representation of the Gini coefficient actually produces a value less than one. But intuitively, we would expect the Gini coefficient to reach its maximum value of one in a situation of perfect inequality.
Exactly. The Gini coefficient is meant to range from 0, indicating perfect equality where everyone has the same income, to 1, indicating perfect inequality where one person has all the income. So Sen's formula creates a bit of a conundrum.
The authors of this paper set out to resolve this issue by taking a fresh look at the underlying logic of the Gini coefficient and how it can be derived from a measure of the aggregate income-related depression experienced by a population.
That's a fascinating concept. The idea that income inequality causes psychological distress or depression among those with lower incomes. Can you tell us more about how the researchers approached this?
Yes, let's dive into the details. The core of Sen's representation of the Gini coefficient is the notion that in any pairwise comparison between two individuals, the person with the lower income will experience some degree of depression or dissatisfaction upon realizing their income is lower.
And Sen proposed that this depression is proportional to the difference in income between the two individuals. So the greater the gap, the more depression the poorer individual feels.
Exactly. The Gini coefficient is then defined as the sum total of all these income-related depressions across every possible pairwise comparison in the population. This provides a very intuitive interpretation of what the Gini coefficient is actually measuring.
I see. So the key insight in this new paper is that when you derive the Gini coefficient directly from this aggregate measure of income-related depression, you end up with a well-behaved Gini that does indeed reach the maximum value of 1 when there is perfect inequality.
Yes, that's right. The authors show that by starting with a clean, unambiguous measure of the overall depression experienced by the population, and then eliciting the Gini coefficient from that, you avoid the limitation in Sen's original formulation.
That's fascinating. Can you walk us through the mathematical details of how they arrive at this improved representation of the Gini coefficient?
Sure. Let's dive into the specifics. The key equation is Gini equals sigma y underscore I y underscore j 2n squared mu, where y underscore I and y underscore j are the incomes of individuals I and j, n is the total population size, mu is the mean income.
Okay, so this formula captures the sum of the absolute differences in income between every possible pair of individuals, normalized by the maximum possible value of that sum. That gives you a Gini coefficient that ranges from 0 to 1, as desired.
Exactly. By grounding the Gini coefficient in this direct measure of aggregate income-related depression, the authors are able to derive a version of the statistic that behaves properly, reaching 1 when there is complete inequality.
That's a really elegant solution. I imagine this revised understanding of the Gini coefficient could have some important implications. What are some of the key takeaways and potential impacts?
There are a few notable points. First, the authors suggest that this well-behaved Gini coefficient could provide a more intuitive and meaningful interpretation of income inequality by directly connecting it to the psychological experience of those with lower incomes.
That's an interesting angle. Tying the abstract statistical measure to real human experiences and emotions.
Absolutely. Additionally, the authors propose that this reformulation could have practical implications for how we use and apply the Gini coefficient in policy and research contexts. If the goal is to accurately quantify the degree of inequality, then having a version of the statistic that reaches its maximum at the point of maximal inequality is important.
Good point. Using the right mathematical representation is crucial, especially when these metrics are being used to guide important decisions and allocate resources.
Exactly. The authors also speculate that this revised Gini coefficient could lead to new ways of thinking about inequality and its drivers. If we view it as a measure of aggregate depression, it opens up avenues for exploring the psychological and social impacts of unequal distributions of income.
Fascinating. This paper really takes a deep dive into the foundations of a widely used economic statistic and uncovers an important limitation, while also proposing an elegant solution. It's a great example of how rigorous mathematical analysis can shed new light on complex real-world phenomena.
Absolutely. Odd Stark and his co-authors have made a valuable contribution here by pushing us to think more critically about how we conceptualize and measure inequality. It's a thought-provoking paper that has the potential to influence how we approach this crucial issue going forward.
Well said. This has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Jen, for walking us through the key insights from this research. Listeners, we hope you found this exploration of the Gini coefficient as interesting and illuminating as we did. Be sure to tune in next time as we dive into another captivating study. Until then, keep inquiring.
Thanks, Tom. This was a pleasure. Goodbye, everyone.
Are you tired of feeling down about income inequality? Frustrated that the Gini coefficient never seems to fully capture the anguish of economic disparity?
Well, have we got the product for you. Introducing Gini Be Gone, the revolutionary income depression suppression system.
Gini Be Gone uses state-of-the-art psychoacoustic technology to neutralize the psychological effects of income inequality. Simply strap on the Gini Be Gone headset and let the soothing sounds of equal distribution wash over you.
No more obsessing over the ever-widening wealth gap. Genie Be Gone will have you feeling like a millionaire, even if your net worth is closer to minimum wage.
Genie Be Gone. Because ignorance is bliss, and we're here to make you blissfully ignorant of how poor you are compared to the 1%.
Side effects may include a fleeting sense of contentment, temporary delusions of adequacy, and a creeping suspicion that you're part of the problem. But who cares? You'll be too busy singing kumbaya to notice.
Genie Be Gone. Restoring your faith in capitalism, one soothing audio track at a time. Available now for 3 easy payments of $19.95. Operators are standing by.
Genie Be Gone. Because the truth shall set you free. Free to ignore it, that is.
Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to our award-winning podcast, where we investigate cutting-edge research with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we're diving into a fascinating study that explores the impact of golden visa programs on real estate markets. The paper is titled All That Glitters? Golden Visas in Real Estate and is authored by João Pereira dos Santos and Cristina Stromeyer.
Golden visas have become an integral part of contemporary migration policies, providing a pathway for individuals to acquire new legal status through financial investments. This study focuses on the case of Portugal, which launched its Golden Visa program in 2012, allowing foreign investors to obtain residency permits by purchasing real estate worth at least 500,000 euros.
The researchers were interested in understanding the extent to which these Golden Visa programs impact local housing markets. Using comprehensive transaction data from Portugal, they set out to uncover any distortions or price premiums associated with the Golden Visa scheme.
The researchers first conducted a bunching analysis, which is a technique that looks for clustering of data points around key thresholds. In this case, they examined the distribution of real estate transactions before and after the introduction of the Golden Visa program, focusing on the 500,000 euro price point.
And what did they find?
The bunching analysis revealed a clear spike in the number of transactions exactly at the 500,000 euro threshold after the program was introduced. In fact, the researchers found a 60% increase in the excess mass of transactions at this price point compared to the pre-reform period.
Wow, that's a significant jump. This suggests that the Golden Visa program caused significant distortions in the real estate market, with sellers potentially strategically pricing their properties around the 500,000 euro mark to attract foreign investors.
Exactly. But the researchers didn't stop there. They then merged the transaction data with property tax records, which provided information on the fiscal value of each property, a measure of its objective characteristics like size, age, and location.
Ah, I see what they're getting at. By comparing the transaction prices to the fiscal values, they can assess whether the Golden Visa program led to a premium in housing prices.
Precisely. Using a difference in differences approach, the researchers compared the gap between transaction prices and fiscal values for properties just above and just below the 500,000 euro threshold. This allowed them to isolate the impact of the Golden Visa program.
And what did they find?
The results were striking. The researchers uncovered a significant Golden Visa premium. Properties at the 500,000 euro threshold had transaction prices that exceeded their fiscal values by an average of around 38,000 euros. This suggests that the prospect of gaining residency through the Golden Visa program capitalized into housing prices, leading to a more than 10% increase in high-end property values.
Fascinating. So not only did the Golden Visa program distort the distribution of transactions, but it also seems to have driven up prices for the types of properties that qualified for the program. This must have had significant implications for housing affordability in Portugal.
Absolutely. The researchers also found that Golden Visa buyers tended to purchase older but larger properties in less central locations compared to the pre-reform period. This indicates that the program may have led these investors to prioritize meeting the investment threshold over other housing characteristics.
That's a really interesting insight. It suggests the Golden Visa program influenced the types of properties that were in demand, potentially crowding out local buyers who were looking for different housing attributes.
Exactly. and the researchers didn't stop there. They also surveyed a representative sample of the Portuguese population to gauge public opinion on the Golden Visa program.
What did they find?
The survey results were quite striking. Despite the potential economic benefits of the program, a significant portion of the Portuguese public, especially the elderly and highly educated residents in Lisbon, favored ending the Golden Visa scheme. Many were concerned about its impact on housing affordability and broader societal implications.
Wow, that's really insightful. So even though the Golden Visa program may have succeeded in attracting foreign investment, it seems to have come at a cost to local residents, particularly in terms of housing prices and availability.
Absolutely. This study provides a comprehensive look at how these types of residency by investment programs can have far-reaching impacts on local real estate markets. The researchers were able to uncover both the distortive effects on transaction prices as well as the public sentiment around the program.
It's a great example of how rigorous economic analysis can illuminate the nuanced trade-offs and unintended consequences of policies that may seem straightforward on the surface. The findings really highlight the need for policymakers to carefully consider the broader societal impacts of Golden Visa schemes, not just the headline investment figures.
Exactly. This research contributes to our understanding of how capital flows and migration policies can shape local housing markets in complex ways. It's a fascinating study that blends cutting-edge empirical analysis with a deep appreciation for the real-world implications. I found it to be a powerful example of how economic research can inform critical policy debates.
Absolutely. This is the kind of work that really gets to the heart of important issues facing societies today. The researchers did an excellent job of not just presenting the data, but crafting a compelling narrative that brings the findings to life. I'm sure our listeners will find this episode both informative and thought-provoking.
I couldn't agree more. Thanks for joining me today, Jen. This was a really engaging discussion, and I'm sure our audience will be just as captivated by this research as we are.
Absolutely, Tom. Thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll be back soon with more fascinating insights from the cutting edge of research. Until next time.
Are you tired of paying outrageous prices for your dream home just to satisfy the Golden Visa quota?
Introducing Visa Villas, the one-stop shop for all your Golden Visa real estate needs.
With Visa Villas, you can skip the headache of finding that perfect 500,000 euro property. We'll do the work for you.
Just tell us your budget, and our team of savvy real estate agents will source the perfect pre-overpriced property. We guarantee it'll meet that Golden Visa threshold, no questions asked.
Forget about location, size, or even structural integrity. At Visa Villas, we prioritize one thing, getting you that coveted residency permit, no matter the cost.
So what are you waiting for? Visit visavillas.pt and let us handle the dirty work of gaming the system. Because when it comes to Golden Visas, all that glitters is our bottom line.
Visa Villas. Residency made easy, for a price. Here is the full transcript for the podcast episode. Hello and welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the latest groundbreaking research. I'm Tom, and alongside me is my co-host Jen.
Hi everyone. Today we're going to be discussing a fascinating new paper that explores the consequences of miscarriage on parental investments. The paper is titled The Consequences of Miscarriage on Parental Investments, and it's authored by Aileen Beautykofer, Deirdre Coy, Orla Doyle, and Rita Ginger.
Miscarriage is a surprisingly common experience, affecting around 15 to 20% of all pregnancies worldwide. And yet, we still have a lot to learn about how this traumatic event can impact parents and their subsequent children. This paper takes an in-depth look at that very question, using comprehensive data from Norway to uncover some fascinating insights.
The researchers found that experiencing a miscarriage actually leads parents to make significant investments in their next pregnancy. Mothers who have had a miscarriage are more likely to take folic acid and multivitamins, quit smoking, and get additional prenatal testing compared to mothers who haven't had a loss. They also increase the number of visits to their healthcare providers during the subsequent pregnancy.
Interestingly, this heightened level of investment doesn't seem to be driven by poorer maternal health. In fact, the researchers found that women who experienced a miscarriage actually had better physical health indicators, like lower rates of gestational hypertension, during their next pregnancy.
So why are these women investing more? The researchers believe it may be a coping mechanism, a way for mothers to take more control and feel more prepared after the trauma of a miscarriage. There's also evidence that healthcare providers become more cautious and order additional tests and checkups for these women, likely out of an abundance of caution.
And the increased investment doesn't stop there. The researchers also found that mothers who had a miscarriage took more sick leave during their subsequent pregnancy, and were less engaged in the labor market for up to 2 years after giving birth.
Interestingly, this reduced labor market participation didn't seem to be driven by poorer maternal health. Rather, it suggests these mothers may be prioritizing increased time and care for their new baby, as a way to offset the trauma of their previous loss.
So what about the kids? You might expect all this extra care and investment to translate into better outcomes for the children born after a miscarriage. But the data tells a more nuanced story.
That's right. For the most part, the researchers found limited impacts on the children. There was a small increase in birth weight, but no differences in other measures like APGA scores or rates of low birth weight. The kids also didn't differ in their healthcare utilization in the first 2 years of life.
The authors think this lack of effect may be due to a balancing act, the negative impacts of any lingering stress or anxiety from the miscarriage being offset by the positive impacts of increased maternal investment. Without direct measures of maternal stress, it's hard to tease apart these countervailing forces.
Absolutely. This is a really fascinating study that sheds new light on an important and understudied topic. By documenting the behavioral changes of both parents and healthcare providers in response to miscarriage, the researchers have uncovered a complex web of defensive investments that have significant implications, both for families and for society as a whole.
I'm really struck by how common miscarriage is, yet how little we seem to understand about its ripple effects. This paper is an important step forward, but there's still so much more to explore. For example, the researchers note that they had to exclude certain groups, like women who never had a subsequent birth, which could mean they're missing some of the most severe consequences.
That's a really good point. And of course, this is all happening within the context of Norway's generous social safety net, which may shape how parents respond. It would be fascinating to see if similar patterns emerge in healthcare systems with different incentives and constraints.
Definitely. There are a lot of unanswered questions, but this study provides a strong foundation. By documenting these behavioral changes in such granular detail, the authors have given us a much richer understanding of how miscarriage can reverberate through families. It's a powerful reminder that even the earliest stages of life can have lasting impacts.
Absolutely. This research really highlights the importance of supporting women and families who experience pregnancy loss. Miscarriage is still too often dismissed or minimized, but studies like this show the very real and significant toll it can take. Hopefully, this will help spur more discussion, empathy, and resources for those going through such a difficult experience.
Couldn't agree more. This was a really compelling and insightful look at a crucial yet underexplored topic. Thanks for joining us today, and we look forward to digging into more fascinating research in future episodes.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll catch you next time.
Here is a dystopian future commercial for a company that emerged as a result of the research covered in the podcast episode. Are you feeling anxious and overwhelmed after a recent miscarriage?
Introducing Motherhood Armor, the one-stop shop for all your post-pregnancy protection needs.
At Motherhood Armor, we know how devastating a miscarriage can be. That's why we've developed a cutting-edge line of maternal investment products to give you the peace of mind you deserve.
Our premium folic acid supplements will fortify you for your next pregnancy. Our top-of-the-line pregnancy test kits will let you know the moment your body is ready. And our state-of-the-art electronic fetal monitors will track your baby's every heartbeat, 24/7.
With Motherhood Armor, you'll never have to worry about the trauma of another loss. We'll wrap you in a cocoon of safety and support, so you can finally relax and enjoy the miracle of life.
Don't settle for subpar prenatal care. Upgrade to Motherhood Armor today. Because in this dystopian future, the only way to protect your family is to invest. Tom and Jen. Motherhood Armor, Fortress of the Future.